Welcome to Normal Adjustments, because not all tales are created equal, and neither the people that tell them. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Normal Adjustments. This is your host, Nicole. Another week, another great guest. And today with me, I have a doctor of the NHS, right, Lewis?
That's right, yeah.
Is it a doctor in the NHS?
It is, yeah. So I'm a GP in the NHS.
For those that don't know, GP is a general practitioner for my audience in Puerto Rico and the US. For the UK, they really know what a GP is. But yeah, general practitioner is just a general doctor that is basically your first point of contact before seeing anybody else within the kind of health system in the UK.
Uh-huh. In some places, they call it family medicine.
Right, family medicine. Yeah, well, welcome, Lewis. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. So yeah, Lewis and I were introduced by mutual friends, and we were talking, and I was sent a very nice piece of, is it a blog?
Yeah, I would say it's a blog. So I think it's the only way to describe it. It's a little bit like a diary entry, but it's a blog for everybody to read.
Right, right. It's a diary entry, like a blog that he wrote a couple of months ago. And it really resonated with me. And it talks about the topic of anxiety and in general, like mental health that you yourself experienced. For the audience that don't know, but I have an episode on anxiety and my journey with anxiety. And a friend's kind of like just talking a bit about our background in it, and there's a lot to talk about in the topic. I've always seen or spoken quietly with male friends about their journeys, but it is very taboo. It's not really widely spoken, and within men themselves, I think it is not something that it's encouraged to do or talk about. So yeah, I really wanted to have this topic in the podcast. So thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So to start, I want to start with like your early years. From my childhood, I could see like patterns that maybe was like you could have anxiety in the future, like a bit of perfectionism, a bit of the way that in my household was structured. And of course, like those things triggered, probably coming also from my disease and my condition, probably if you don't attend those things and mental health early on, probably it's like you see it coming. Some people don't have that at all. But I want it not only related to anxiety, but I wanted you to talk about like your upbringing and your beginning.
Yeah. So, I was brought up in London, in South London, and just lived with my mum and my three siblings. So I had two brothers and one sister, and they were all older than me. My mum and my dad had separated when I was one, so I didn't really live with him at all. And yeah, just grew up with them. It's interesting that you mentioned some of the signs that you see early on, because it's when I spoke to my mum about the anxiety I was suffering with, she kind of said, well, actually, you were always a bit of an anxious child. And then there were some things within childhood that, as you said, you know, you look back and you can see the signs of it and that it was there a little bit, but just manifested in a different way. Exactly. And maybe not to a harmful level, but it was certainly there a little bit. A little bit of a thinker and a bit of a warrior.
Similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's similar. So you grew up in London. Your whole life stayed in London?
So my whole life I've lived in London. I did spend 1 year in Brighton. That was when I qualified as a doctor. We have to do 1 year inside London, 1 year out. And my year out of London was down in Brighton. So I did that. But other than that, I've always stayed in London. It's just a city that kind of has everything for me. And, you know, it's easy to get out of London to the countryside and to nice areas. It's got parks, but it has a bit of variety and everything you kind of want.
Yeah, no, I mean, you don't have to sell it to me. I love it.
Yeah, we've got you here. Yeah.
The reason I also wanted to cover kind of your trajectory in becoming a doctor is because I also know that, you know, that is a very stressful time. And I wanted kind of you to elaborate a bit of like, how did that look like for you?
Yeah, I think originally, especially when I was younger, there were no pressures for me to become a doctor. You know, I didn't come from a very academic family. And, you know, my elder siblings all sort of dropped out of school when they were 16, 17. None of them went to university. I have an uncle and an aunt who went to university, but within the family that were close by, they were the only ones. So for me, initially, actually, I wanted to be a footballer. And even when I wanted to be a footballer, I wanted to help people. So I thought that, you know, I'd get involved in politics through football and use that platform. And then I thought to myself, if I don't make it as a footballer, what else could I do? And medicine was the thing that I thought was best, because I was very good at science. And I thought, well, actually, that way I can help people. So I decided that I would go into medicine as my backup for football. And yeah, I mean, I was quite lucky that I study very easily and I learn very easily. I have a very good memory, so I could pick up things quite quickly. So most of my studying throughout, like college, A-levels, getting into university was fine. I didn't really feel too much stress or pressure. It only really came more when I got to my last 2 years of medicine. And at that point, I didn't really have the money. If I failed a year, I wouldn't have had the money to go back and retake that year. And I knew that. So I almost had to qualify. I had to pass the exams on the first attempt. And the exams are obviously quite difficult and stressful. And I think that pressure was a little bit more. And that's where I probably started to feel a bit of anxiety around, you know, would I qualify? Would I pass?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I never had an aspiration of becoming a doctor, but I saw my friends' journeys and I'm like, not interested. The amount of tests, and I'm not a good test taker. I mean, I'm an engineer by profession, but not a good test taker, I swear.
It's difficult. Like, I think because I'm very good at written exams and I have the knowledge inside, but within medicine, we have two types of exams, two main types. One would be a written paper. And then the other is what we call an OSCE, which is basically observed clinical skills. What they do to test this is you go into a room, you know, you have 6 or 7 minutes, and it's sometimes it's a real patient, but often it's a pretend patient, and you have to either take a history, examine, and it will be different aspects that you have to show that you can do. And you'll do, you know, 20 plus stations of doing that over 2 hours, and that will be a test. And I found those tests quite difficult. I think, again, not coming from a medical background, you almost felt like you were pretending to be a doctor at that stage. And you know, you felt a little bit like an imposter. And so I found that quite challenging. Those feelings of sort of insecurity maybe showed itself up, and the other doctors looked at it as a lack of confidence. So I was like having to make sure I got the marks and a little less sure than I would be with a written paper.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it's like other people maybe with, like you say, like a background of or being exposed to it would just like feel so normal in it, but it's like an unconscious bias or something, right? Which is interesting. And it's an interesting, you wrote in your blog an interesting fact. You said, I have always had some degree of anxiety, but what I consider normal on a protective level. And when I read that, it really resonated because I've said similar things. I've actually said that I don't like to describe it as anxiety. I like to describe it as stress, like stressors, but that I need stressors in order to push me to do things. So I've noticed that at moments when I like burst like either on like a moment of frustration or anger, that makes me set things up into motion of like, oh, like this not cannot continue this way, therefore I need to do X, Y, Z, whatever. And then that's how I sent all my emails, or you know, so that that resonated in that way with me.
No, so I think you're right in that way. Sometimes you do need that sort of anxiety to push you a little bit, and it drives you a little bit. And there are certain aspects of my life where I think that anxiety that I have inside has pushed me to kind of always be better. You know, I had to study hard because I had that anxiety there to say, well, you have to do this. You have to make sure you pass, you know. The same I mentioned in the blog about football. You know, when I play football, I would feel stressed if I lost the match or if I had a big match coming up, but it made me practice harder. So I trained harder, I worked harder, I got fitter. All these things kind of push you a little bit. And I guess I needed that in some ways.
And that's why it resonates, because if I like go back or like even the present time, I operate in that way. Like in moments of extreme calmness, I feel stressed because I'm like, why is it so calm? Like I might be missing an opportunity, which is the reason I bring this up is this correlation between like the anxiety that you need to be driven versus the anxiety that causes burnout. because it drives you to a point of burnout. I have a friend that is a burnout coach now. I've had her in the podcast once. Like, we talked about burnout last season. She wrote a blog about burnout in teams. And it's that, like, how the structure is operates in a way of, like, never stopping, right? It's and forever. So, like, either you burn out or you, how do you stop? And it just, like, the modern world, I think it operates. Who gets to burnout quicker or who is able to sustain the burnout? That doesn't mean that you're stronger than the other. It's just that maybe you have some enablement around you that allows you to sustain the burnout, like help at home. You're able to kind of, maybe you're able to live without exercise or you're able to over-exercise.
Yeah, there can be this kind of drive that you always have these things to achieve and there's always something further to keep you reaching. And no matter what you do, there will always be something else, you know. And for example, in your career, you know, career-wise, maybe becoming a GP partner where I have, I've reached as high as I can, but actually there's more, you know. You can then go on to, you can run the local committees and you can join those and you can keep trying to climb ladders. But as you said, you know, there's a point where you are going to burn out and you're going to reach a stage.
Yeah, like where's the level of satisfaction?
I found it interesting that when with myself, I kind of had these targets that I had in mind. So buying a house, becoming a GP partner, you know, getting the car that I want, these kind of things. And almost once I reached a stage where I had them, is where the anxiety then started to manifest. It was like you're operating almost on an unconscious level. You just keep going. You have a target. You take that target away now and you're here. And like you said, it's a bit of calm. But in that calm, you suddenly realize actually what is happening here. And that's where the anxiety sort of manifested a bit more.
And I totally relate because I'm currently in like a crossroads like that at work, my 9-to-5 job. It's a good opportunity about like potentially promotion. But I have to put work in it. I never thought I was going to do it. I'm going to that next step. But why not enjoy the calmness or the status quo I might not have? One of my biggest lessons last year is kind of the surrendering to the universe and trusting the process. Because this push and this drive and this push and this drive sometimes kind of get you mixed up into the expectations of something. And then sometimes when something doesn't happen and the expectation doesn't happen, that's where the letdown comes in and then potentially a depression or an anxious period. While it's like you might have some aspirations, but if you leave them loose of like just let them be, they might manifest in a way that you feel more grateful rather than just getting to that goal, like you say. And it's like, oh, now I'm here. And you don't enjoy it because it's just like, now what's next? So I've tried very hard recently to kind of change my mindset around it. But we fall back into old patterns. So it's something I have to continuously remind myself.
I think, when you've done something for 20 odd years, it's very difficult to then change the way that you think and the way that you focus. It doesn't happen overnight and you'll always have to.
Yeah, we adjust all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
And with that topic, I wanted to also use a quote that you wrote in the blog that said, I often say that our capacity for handling stress is a bit like filling up a cup of water. We all have cups of different sizes and can often handle one or two things. But at some point when the stressful situations build up, the cup will overflow. The water pours out and the symptoms will really manifest. And that was like a cathartic moment. And can you like run us through with what that moment was for you?
So, yeah, it's interesting because this phrase is something I often use with my patients to explain to them why their anxiety had come now. Because often people will say to you, well, you know, I've dealt with this stress in the past. I've had much worse situations. Why am I now suffering anxiety? Why can I now not sleep? And then for myself, you know, the sort of moment when I realized was it was a buildup of physical symptoms that then led to me realizing actually I'm really suffering with anxiety and that I couldn't get it to settle down. So that's what really made me realize when it started affecting my body. And initially I just would blame it on other things, you know, oh, I'm a bit tired today and that's why, or I ate something spicy, that's why I'm getting gastritis and I'm getting palpitations, but it's because I'm worried about this meeting I have tomorrow. But then you realize eventually, actually, it's not going away. That feeling doesn't go away. I think that's when it kind of hit home for me. And it was actually at the time I was seeing somebody and was spending the weekend with them. And usually I would have felt happy and sort of content. But even in that situation, my chest felt tight, my heart was racing, and I just knew that something wasn't quite right. And I needed to do something about it at that point.
Yeah. And again, it resonates a lot. Like I remember being in a relationship that being with them, like present, I was just be thinking about like things that will cause me stress or anxiety. And them not being there also will cause that anxiety in another level because I was like a worrier and an overthinker of other stuff. So it was like, when are you content? Yeah. Like when is it going to be like that? You're going to feel at ease.
I think it also can cause problems. So like in this relationship, almost most of the time being around her, I felt at ease and felt fine until this kind of moment when the anxiety had become too much. But that almost became, for me, I needed that person around more because they made me feel better and stopped the anxiety. But that's a lot of pressure for somebody else to deal with. And, you know, everybody else has Absolutely. Their own situations and you can't really put that on somebody else. You have to be here to make me feel better. It doesn't really work like that.
No, and support cannot be mistaken by clutches, right? Like another person, it can be a support system and you're there for that other person, but also putting all that work or all that pressure into someone is not fair because that whatever moment in their lives they are also in, there needs to be like an empathy side of things. Like, are they able to sustain whatever support you need? And that's not a negative on them either because they're also human. And it's something I also had to learn with the punches because I think I did that or expected that from someone. And like then you use or other people use adjectives. So it's like, oh, that asshole or like whatever. And it's like when you look back, not necessarily that person was not maybe not equipped or not in a place to actually handle that.
Certainly. I think so. And I think you have to be mindful of everybody else's situation. I think that's important, what their capacity is. And that's why the sort of in the quote that you just said from the blog where I talk about cups of different sizes, and everybody does, you know, everybody has a different ability to handle stress, and something that you think might be minor for that other person can be major and can sort of overflow their capacity. So it's we have to be aware and listen to what people say and also give a space for people to talk about their anxiety or not necessarily anxiety, but how they're feeling and what their capacity is to support you.
Yeah, that's true too. I think the more we talk about these things also the better because, you know, I think that they all say that the first step is the recognition. I'm not only saying that from anxiety, from many other things, like recognizing. So if we are educated a little bit or like societal wise or like as people, that I might be going through this, then you might be able to know what to do as well. Because I think that there's also an element of what's my next step. At least you were a doctor and you were able to diagnose or at least look for ways to help yourself and recognize it. Not that every doctor would, but I mean that was in your knowledge. and I had my education as well in those topics, but a lot of people don't. And it's mistaken by other things. And sometimes, like you say, which is why I want you to talk next, is the physical symptoms that manifested. And then sometimes, many times, you see people putting patches on the physical symptoms rather than really attending the root cause.
And I think that's one of the interesting things, especially with me being a doctor. And I'm very sensitive to mental health, you know. For lots of reasons, I have a close relationship with it and I've always tried to understand it and tried to learn more about it. And so when patients come into me, often I recognize their physical symptoms that they present with. And in my head, I can say, well, I know that this is anxiety. You know, you have somebody with palpitations that's, you know, in their mid-20s and they think, oh, I'm having a heart attack. It's something wrong with my heart. And you recognize actually it's not. And you try to delve in and you say, you know, are you stressed about anything? You ask them questions around it. often you have to do, for me as a doctor, I have to do lots of tests to prove to them your heart is fine. You know, I'll do blood tests, I'll do an ECG. And then I'll say to them, well, look, these tests are all fine. So now I'm telling you these palpitations, it's down to stress and anxiety, and we need to work on that. Will you accept us working on that? With me having to do that, you know, on a weekly basis in my job, you would think that I would be ready to recognize the symptoms quicker. But even so, when I started to suffer from them, especially initially, it was almost, well, this is just a physical symptom. You know, in the blog, I talk about the first symptom that I got was gastritis. So heartburn or reflux type symptoms. Yeah. And I would eat things and it would make me feel very nauseous. And I would feel the acid coming up behind my chest. And it made it hard for me to eat. And I was actually struggling to eat at certain times. Some days I would go without eating. And I would just try to treat that as a physical symptom. You know, I took, there's a medicine we have called omeprazole that you can buy over the counter. And I took some of that. I cut out certain things from the diet. I reduced my caffeine intake and it got better. Reduced my spicy foods and it improved. So I was like, okay, that physical symptom has been dealt with. And then the palpitations develop and you think, oh, well, why does my chest feel tight and why am I getting palpitations and what is happening here? And again, you start to realize, you start to attribute it to something else. Like I said before, oh, is it because I have a meeting? It's just something coming up that it will settle down. And even things like I wear a sports watch and it tells me my resting heart rate. My resting heart rate had increased by, you know, 7 or 8 beats per minute. And I was training more than usual because we were in lockdown and all I could do was train. But my resting heart rate wasn't coming down. And I looked at it and thought that's strange, but again, didn't put all the pieces together. It kind of showed me how easy it is to not mistake the physical symptoms, but to let the physical symptoms be the priority and not recognize the cause of the physical symptom.
Exactly. No, it resonates so much. I also experienced the stomach problems, to be honest, for a long time. And even now, because I'm able to recognize it so much, if I'm like in high level of stress, like I feel different. My stomach feel more bloated. People stress eat. I am the opposite. So it sounds like you are too. It suppresses my hunger when I'm in like high level of stress or anxiety. Like the days that I have very important meetings or something, even if I plan to do a breakfast, I just am not hungry. My strive is always consistency because like a plateau level, which like these things don't go into a highs of not too much happiness, not too much like sadness, right? Like how can I be in like a consistent balanced level? Because a lot of people talk about like, oh, my strive is to be happy. I'm like, I actually strive to be consistently, because the other one is also not sustainable. So then there was one more physical symptom that it's the one that I really think, well, I mean, it's taboo to talk about, a lot of stigma, and even I think women needs to be educated on it as well. So you tell us about
again, it's something that so when I write, often I like to be very open and to explain things. And this, it took a lot for me to actually be able to write it and for me to then publish it and say it, just thinking of how will people react? Because like you said, it's a taboo subject. So I think the final way that the anxiety affected me when it had built to such a crescendo was that it gave me problems gaining and keeping an erection. Initially I didn't tie it to the anxiety. You know, I blamed it on other things. I do some cycling and I thought, oh, it's just that I did a lot of cycling. And also I ate something that upset my stomach and I thought that could be the cause. And, you know, I knew that I was attracted to the person that I was with. I knew it wasn't a loss of libido or that I didn't want it. I wanted it, but I just couldn't do it. And I couldn't figure out why. And it was very interesting the way, even when it would come to the time to perform sexually, I'd be then getting even worse palpitations and I would get sweaty and clammy and my heart would be racing and my thoughts would be racing and my thoughts would be saying, you know, don't lose your erection, don't lose your erection. And then that's basically what would happen. And as you said, it's something that's difficult to talk about. Men don't talk about it. And the thing in my head when I was even writing about it was not so much like my male friends that I'm close with, I could explain to them, you know, and we have spoken about it in the past. But for example, when I go and play football, what would the people that I play football with in the dressing room talk about? would they make jokes about it if they read it? You know, what would they say? And I kind of felt like, actually, I need to be strong enough to handle that, because I know that it's not a physical problem. I know that it's not something that makes me less of a man. I know that it's something that happens. And actually, I knew that I could cure it and to could get rid of it and would get rid of it eventually. So, yeah, I thought it was important to talk about and important to be open about.
Absolutely important to talk about and open about. And I admire you and commend you to do it. I've had to do a lot of similar things for my community and difficult topics around like lymphedema. Again, I resonate a lot, but I like that you said it because look, I've been in multiple relationships and I've seen it happen in the past. And then I've heard the comments, but from men, but in like a very quiet way of like, oh, it's too much pressure, or oh, it's as women, you know, like as gender, I would say we're like traditionally empathetic. Uh-huh. Not all of us. I'm not saying it's a generalization, but and we try to understand. But then what we take it on sometimes is like, oh, he doesn't like me, or what am I doing wrong? So it's also something about open conversations and communications, because it's if you recognize that that might be a reason giving of something else, which is the root cause, then we can all understand each other better, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's important, because even though for myself, I could in a way I could explain it, and I knew that it wasn't the other person, partly feeling like I was letting that person down made it even worse of a cycle. Mm-hmm. I think outwardly they knew that it wasn't them, because the experience we had before, it wasn't like it was my first time with them. We'd been together. We knew we had an attraction to each other, but it still made them question a little bit. Well, why is it happening with me? And that made me feel bad, you know? And like you say, that having the conversation and being able to talk about it is very important, because that becomes a bit of an issue. And I could see why very easily that cycle could continue. And for myself, in a way, I was fortunate because I recognized that the anxiety was a major cause. And once I started treating the anxiety, the erection problem went away, you know, within a week. And so that it was only one weekend that it really affected me, and it didn't really trouble me that much afterwards, unless the anxiety built up again. You know, at times over the next few months, I kind of stopped taking medication or things. And so the anxiety built up and it came a little bit again, but never to that extreme. But I could see why some people would get trapped in this cycle. And then, as you said, it's a performance issue. And will I perform? And that becomes psychologically damaging, and it can affect relationships, you know. And you see it affect relationships and people break up because of it, and that's where it can be very harmful. And it's not an issue of attraction, it's something that can be solved and can be treated if we're more open about it.
Yeah, exactly. And on we can understand each other better, like I said before, because I think it's an empathy angle as well. And then I kind of wanted to touch on the COVID angle, because all of this happened while also COVID is in play. Uh-huh. And you are a doctor in a country that had a lot of COVID. I mean, the whole world had a lot of COVID. But how did that play out, just like out of interest? Did that added stress? Like how was your life affected during that period?
Yeah, I mean, it really definitely added stress, and it built up over time. And it was very difficult, because being a doctor and very interested in science, I always knew that a sort of pandemic was coming. Then around, I think sort of mid-February, I started to realize that what you were hearing about what was happening in China, this was actually the pandemic, and it was going to change the world. Mm-hmm. And knowing what was coming, that was anxiety inducing in itself. How will I protect the people I love? How will I keep my mom safe? You know, what will work be like? And then it sort of hits England, and you can see also the government not acting in the way you think they should. You know, they should lock down, they should see what's happening in Italy, they should lock down, but they're not doing it. I'm sitting here, you know, I'm a GP, but paying an interest in science, and I can see what's going to come. This is going to happen in 2 weeks. This is going to happen in 4 weeks. Why are they not acting? You know, and that was very, that induced a lot of anxiety for me. I found it very difficult to sleep at times. You know, I would yeah, just be awake, thinking about things and wanting some sort of action.
No, it was, I couldn't, I if it was stressful for me, I don't want to know how stressful it was for the medical community.
I think that was one aspect. So looking at what the government were doing and then not acting. And then it just changed our way of working. I don't think many people in the medical profession were worried about themselves. For myself, for example, I knew that I had seen people with COVID and, mm-hmm. you know, I hadn't caught it off them or I had, and I had symptoms. So I wasn't worried about myself dying from it, for example. It was just keeping other people safe. How do I keep most people safe with this going on? And then, you know, as a GP, we had to stop patients coming into our waiting room. So we had to see less patients face to face because you can't have 30 people in the waiting room, because if two of them have COVID, now 30 of them have COVID, and you've got elderly patients and vulnerable people. So there was just nothing else we could do but to completely change the way we worked. We had to go to telephones or videos and, you know, only seeing people face to face when we really had to. So a lot of change in, you know, the profession you've learned and you've practiced for 6-7 years suddenly changes over a period of 2 or 3 weeks, and you're practicing a slightly different kind of medicine, but still having people's lives in your hands.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but thank you for that. I thought it was interesting to kind of like touch a little bit on it. Because while you're going through this, of course, like the world is going through its own thing, which is like a variable in there, of course. So yeah, I wanted to go into kind of what I call your acceptance of your anxiety. and I say it because then you come to like that realization, but you said it in a very kind of interesting way. It's like, you don't like to call yourself like a typical man, but like a typical man, it took a problem with your penis to wake you up. And I really like that sentence. It's just funny. But I wanted you to then talk about kind of what tools, what mechanisms and things you did to then take control.
So for me, as I say in the blog, you know, it took the problems with the erection, then that potentially affected the relationship that I was in, for me to realize actually this is not normal. This, the way that you've been feeling for the last few weeks, it's not normal, and you need to do something now about your anxiety. And as I said before, I'd had a certain level of anxiety throughout my life, but it never spilled over. It never reached the point that it affected me or stopped me doing normal things. Occasionally, you know, sleepless nights or waking up early, but that would be if I had an exam or a big football match. Then suddenly now it's affecting you 24 hours a day almost. You can't eat properly. You can't sleep properly. You can't have a normal relationship. You are also having erection problems, and that's almost the icing on the cake of a, you know, not a very nice icing, but the icing on the cake. So then I had to think, well, what do I need to do? And I think for myself, I'd reached a point where the symptoms are so continuous, and I'd almost let it develop so far along, and it'd probably been building up over a period of 2 or 3 years, you know, one sort of stress after another, that I felt I had to use medication. And often with patients, I use medication as the last thing that we try. But with myself, I knew that I had to take the medicine because I needed to calm that anxiety down for anything to work. Because I did actually try to start meditating, but it was just impossible. You know, I just couldn't get any calm in that situation. It had gone too far.
No, I actually... that also resonates because a lot of people there, and I love that you said it, because a lot of people have stigmas over medication for anxiety or depression. And even people that are in it hide it for years and years because they're like, they don't like to talk about it. But like you said, like people don't realize that sometimes when your nervous system just goes out of whack, it needs that stabilization. That's where those things are for. And I believe in those things to create that stabilization, because I've had to do it as well. Because like you said, then I would try to go to yoga or a meditation class, and that calmness would give me more anxiety than actually calm me. Because I was like, my body, it's not ready to get to this place right now. Or like my mind is not ready. So I'm glad that you talked about that too.
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, as I say, the sort of sexual side of things, but also because the person that I was in a relationship up until that happened, I had felt better around them. Then suddenly I didn't, the anxiety was just still there. And so I knew then there wasn't, you're using that person as a crutch, you know, but actually you need to treat this and you need to sort this out. And that's what I felt that I needed to do that. And like you say, just bring that level down a little bit so that everything else can work. And then, you know, I did other things where I used the knowledge that I have, but also people that I know that work in the field. So I know some psychotherapists, and they sent me some cognitive behavioral therapy workbooks, which is, again, it's what I'd recommend to patients, and it's very effective. So I started working through those. I also started meditation. I cut back on exercise, which was, exercise was always a coping mechanism for me. But it had gone the other way, where I was actually exercising too much and pushing it too much. And then that was affecting me negatively. So I then cut back and did it at a lower level, a lower intensity for a little bit of time to obviously keep up exercise, but also to allow some rest as well. Like my body and mind needed a rest.
Actually, it's interesting because sometimes people don't realize that even though, yes, exercise is one of the very good things when you don't do anything or you've never exercised to combat stressors or get your mind in a better place or combat anxiety, like you say, it can work the other way. Include, like now there's conversations about how time of the month affects women in their performance of anxiety, of exercising as well, and how you should honor those days and moments to kind of like let your body go through what's happening and then maybe retake it or in a lower impact way. Because definitely the performance on sports and exercise is affected because your body's going
absolutely
through something.
And I think one thing that's interesting with women is that study of how hormones and the cycle can affect women. A lot of it is coming from the sports medicine side of things, because they realized actually, for example, when women are pregnant, they actually get a boost in their performance in early pregnancy. So some athletes started, if they had a competition, they would try to be in early pregnancy arriving at the competition. And that's because of the hormonal changes giving a boost and athletic advantage. And then they start looking at cycles and saying, well, actually your cycle influences and how hard you should train or how intense you should train also should vary through your cycle, not necessarily just when you're on your period that you should rest, but also that at times when the hormones are peaking, you should maybe be thinking about resting or having more intense training at certain times. So it's very interesting to see that being developed.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know those things.
So it is quite interesting seeing how that's being pushed as well in science now. But unfortunately, mainly because of the money involved in sport, that's what's driving it. You know, the plaudits that come with sporting success, everybody wants it. But at least we're making some progress.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So then you also meditated, and then you took your medicine. And how did that go?
Yeah, so I mean, taking the medicine definitely helped. I think that. As you mentioned, you know, you're in this heightened state of agitation almost constantly. And it just brought me down to a place where I was a little bit calmer, where I could then manage things a little bit better and I could start to work at things and use the other methods. I did get some side effects with the medicines. So one of the first things that I got was night sweats, taking sertraline. And then actually, again, going back to the sexual side of things, it was a problem that my patients had complained of before. And I almost didn't think of it as being such a problem, but it gives you some problems with reaching orgasm. So not necessarily that you can't, but it can make it harder. It just takes longer to do so. And then, you know, that can, again, going back to somebody's perspective on it, your partner then thinks, well, why is it taking him so long? You know, again, is it them? Is it you? And me, you know, I knew that it was me and I knew that what the problem was, that it was down to the medicine. But it's very difficult to kind of explain that to somebody or to have them understand it and accept it. And how long do you accept it for? You know, everybody wants to feel desired and wants to feel that they can make their partner come, you know, in that way. So it's a very difficult one to deal with. And I started to recognize a bit more why my patients found it so much of a distressing symptom, because they would often then ask to change, you know, and even if the medicine had helped their anxiety, they then wanted to stop that medicine because of the sexual side of
it. Yeah, so absolutely. Do you think that all this have made you more empathetic towards your patients?
I think certainly. What's interesting, actually, I think I'm much better at recognizing and explaining to people that the symptoms you have are anxiety related, not physical. I think it's made me much better at being sure of that because I've been through it myself. So people explain things and I'm like, I know this, you know, mm-hmm. this is exactly how it felt. I think I do have more empathy in that way. And also in terms of medication, but also I think I'm more confident with patients in saying to them, the medicine can help you. You've reached this point and you need medicine to help you. Whereas before, because of the stigma, I would appreciate and be empathetic to people having that stigma. So people will say, oh, you know, I don't want medicine. I don't want to be addicted to a medicine. I want to do it without medicine. So yeah, for me, I think that made it a lot easier to explain to them, no, it's really helpful. You know, you can use this and you can use it for mm-hmm. a short term and mm-hmm. things will get better.
And there is another quote that you use, which I really enjoy because it's a lot of what I've done in my life, like changing perspective. But mm-hmm. you say, I've worked on my internal monologue. Previously very self-critical, I now try to say, well done for running 5K rather than damn. You ran 4 seconds slower than what you wanted. And that's nice, you know, you explain it simply, but I talk about a lot about changing perspectives and that's exactly it. Sometimes I cannot put it into words anymore because, you know, like I always say that one thing is to understand things yourself and the second part of it is actually learning how to verbalize it. It's not an easy thing to change your perspective, but it certainly helps you and yourself. And your anxiety, because sometimes we're just seeing one side of things, right? And I'm gaining perspective. It's really healing.
Definitely. I think and there's two ways that I actually use that to speak to people again about anxiety, which I think is quite useful. So the first thing is when people tell you about anxiety, sometimes they don't want to tell those close to them, or not necessarily anxiety, but any, you know, depression, anxiety, lots of different problems. And you'll say, well, have you spoken to your wife or your partner about it? Have you spoken to your best friend? And they'll say, you know, no, I don't want to burden them. And the way I turn that back to them and I say, imagine your wife mm-hmm. is feeling the way you are feeling now, would you want her to tell you? And they will always say yes, because they would want that person to confide in them and to tell them. And I say, well, exactly. Your wife would surely want you to confide in them, or your best friend would want you to confide in them. So when you change this perspective in that way, rather than us trying to say, oh, you know, I need to deal with this myself, I need to fight through it, I need to get better, you understand that, you know, you caring for somebody, you want to help them. And that person cares for you and they want to help you. And even just talking about it can be helpful. So it's important they know, you know, the situation. So open up a little bit about it. And I think the same thing mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. comes down to your internal monologue. You look at it the same way. So I've seen it said quite a lot on sort of Instagram videos and things. Now, look at the way you talk to yourself. Mm-hmm. Would you talk to your friend that way? Is that what you would say to your friend? And that's what I then think, you know, if I go and run a 5K, my natural instinct is to come back, oh, you know, I was slower than I wanted to be and I need to get a faster time next time. But if my friend said, oh, I just ran 5K, oh, well done. You just ran 5K. That's brilliant. You know, that's good. At least you got your run done. You know, that's a good start to the day. Mm-hmm, what else are you mm-hmm. going to do today? You'd be very positive about it. You know, so again, it's just changing your perspective and recognizing the way that you talk to yourself is the way that you should talk to other people that you care about. You know, you should care about yourself and talk to yourself in a nice way. And mm-hmm. that's been hard for me because, you know, especially sport wise, I'm always very mm-hmm. critical and I always want to do better. And I always look for the negatives and not just sport wise, even, you know, in terms of my job and the work I do. I worry more about the patients that I get wrong than the patients that I get right. But you have to celebrate your wins. I think that's
right.
It's really important.
Exactly. No, and I always also say that we need to be kinder to ourselves And again, I'm saying this while I'm going to a period in which I'm not being kind of myself at all with like not recognizing everything I've achieved or like, oh, how long I've been. But because in the moment, you forget, but absolutely, like we need to tell ourselves better words. Like I remember there was a time in my life, I didn't like anything about myself. And it's like, I heard this. And the reason I can say this now is because I heard this recently from like a show I watched. And I was like, how is she gonna like anything? Like, that's crazy. And then I remembered that time in myself and I was like, damn, I went through that. So again, it's recognizing that's where you come from and this, how long have you gone to? And it's a narrative that we need to stop because, it's heavy out there. The amount of negativity and bad thoughts we serve ourselves.
And I do wonder, you know, was it to do with COVID and all the general negativity that's in society because of that? You know, every day it's people are dying. We need to be locked down. You know, now we have a war going on. So there's lots of negativity on the outside. And maybe it was okay for me talking to myself in that negative way until this pandemic hit, because there wasn't such a huge negative thing on the outside. But then you put a pandemic on top of you and you just have to sometimes recognize the good things and celebrate even the small wins. You know, I'll say things that seem a bit ridiculous, like I'll do the dishes and I'll say, oh, well, you know, just say to myself, well done for doing the dishes. And obviously it's nothing. It's not an achievement. Anybody can do the dishes, but you just tell yourself it's something good.
No. I agree because I've been there. I started doing gratitude journal last year. And I am not 100% consistent, but when I remember, I like tried at least an entry a week or something. And it's like that is looking at those moments. And it's very, I use it for before bed. Some people use it for start the day. Before bed, for me, it's like a bit of unloading or giving me peace of like, actually, your day, even if it went bad, it wasn't that bad. Because this happened to me. For example, today was a horrible day at work. I started the day like quite stressed and whatever, but then they rang the bell and there was flowers sent to me by the wonderful people I've been working on with the garments. I got it. I saw it. It was nice. It gave me a smile and I forgot about it in 5 minutes. And then I had to stop myself and say, you know, like be grateful for that because that was a beautiful gesture. So I encourage everybody to do those things because even the small things, for example, it's like doing this podcast, being able to do this today. It's a very positive thing. And we lose track of that with like the sea of negativity.
Yeah. And it's very easy. And it's very, you know, when you are in a high performing job and you've kind of climbed the ladder to a height that people look up to, it's almost hard to see that around you, what you achieve just on a day-to-day basis. You know, even you get through one day of work, it's good. And you know, when the anxiety was really bad, I would get through a clinic and say, oh, you know, well done, you know, you did your morning clinic, it's good, no problems, every patient seemed to be happy, you know, I think I got every decision right, well done, you know. And just to look at things a bit more positively and focus on the positives a bit more than what's missing and what you don't have and the negative.
Yeah, no. So well done. Well done for recognizing those things because a lot of people don't. It takes us a long time to get there though. And it's a constant exercise, like we said before.
Definitely. You know, I think, as I said, 30 odd years of living that way and treating myself that way, then you've got to change it. And it takes time.
So Lewis, in the last remarks and closing, what advice would you give? I would say particularly men in this position, just because you really had like very male driven physical symptoms and situations happen. And I really kind of wish to kind of break the stigma in some sort of way in that population, if possible. Or what words of advice can you give?
Yeah, I think the thing that I would say, what's been remarkable, even coming from writing that blog, I was surprised how many people, men especially, stepped forward to say, thank you for writing it. I've also felt similar. I've also been through similar. And you'll be surprised how many people have the same symptoms as you, even within an environment such as, you know, for me, it was always thinking about the football dressing room and that very male, macho dominated sort of atmosphere where you're always trying to get on top. It's all is even the sort of jokes mm-hmm. that you crack is a bit of competition over who's the alpha male within that group. And it's a very testosterone driven environment. Even within that environment, there will be people in that group that suffer from anxiety, people within that group that have suffered from erectile dysfunction. And when you talk about it and when you open up about it, it allows both parties to kind of share and to heal. And that's what's really important. That's what I would recommend. You know, people talk about things a little bit more with those closest to them and who they feel comfortable with as well, you know, open up a little
bit. Vulnerabilities are a wonderful thing. It's very difficult to expose your vulnerabilities, but I think at the end, the reward is incredible.
Yeah, I think definitely. And I've always felt that. And it's things within, you know, my writing and my blogs. And also when I write poems, I'm always able to kind of expose my vulnerable side and my heart, whether it's sadness or whether it's pain, whether I love somebody, you know, all those feelings, I can kind of put them out there. So I felt confident in that way. But these things were hard for me to sort of express easily. And I managed to do it. And I did that because I wanted people to see that vulnerability is fine. And you can still be confident. You know, I'm still confident in myself. I still know that there's lots of attributes that I bring. That there's lots of good things about me. But I suffered with this problem, you know. And that's not a negative. It's something that anybody can go through.
Absolutely. So. It's a way of connecting. It shouldn't be looked as a negative or as a weakness.
Yeah, I hate
that we think that something like that is a weakness. Yeah. Like, for me now it sounds crazy, but I remember when I used to think that way, even at work. I would never talk about my disability or my condition to the extent I would never call it a disability. That's a separate topic of conversation because I would never accept it. But it was because of that, like it was like accepting a weakness or like a soft point that I was too proud to kind of accept when it wasn't like that at all. It was just a fact of me and something to connect on.
Yeah, certainly. I think we all need to appreciate that we all have these areas where, like you say, it's not necessarily a weakness. You know, going back to that aspect of things, you often, when I have patients or men in particular, actually, when I talk about medicine, they'll feel there's a weakness to have to take a medicine to make their mood better. And I always say the example that I give to them, which is probably useful to explain on this podcast, is to say, well, actually, if you had a chest infection, would you want to take antibiotics? Mm-hmm. Well, yes, you know, the antibiotics will treat the infection. If you had a urine infection, would you want to take antibiotics? Yes. So you have anxiety and there's a medicine that can help your anxiety. So why do you see it differently? It's just exactly the same. You know, it's a problem as much as any other and this medicine can help. It's not necessarily the cure, but it can help. So it's not a weakness to take that medicine. You know, we have this avenue to help you. Let it help you, you know, let it make things better. You know, anxiety and depression, it's not a weakness at all. We all suffer from it to some degree. You know, when I say that about the different cup size, I'm sure there's things that I've been through in my life that other people would have struggled to have got through. But I came through that to reach this point. But this is where the anxiety affected me, you know, so at this age with COVID, with a relationship, with, you know, trying to look after my mom, with work stresses, all these things together hit me and affected me with anxiety. That doesn't make me a weak person. You know, it just makes me a normal human being who can suffer with anxiety.
Yeah, like you said, that I love that. It just makes you a human. Well, thank you, Lewis, for being so open and vulnerable and for putting this story out there, because I'm pretty sure, you know, you do work every day to help people, and this definitely, I think, will help others, or at least help others relate, which is what this space is about as well. Not feeling like you're going through whatever you're going through alone, because there's others like you out there, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's important what you said before about this idea of normal. And that's why I love this podcast and the idea of what you're doing and why I kind of wanted to be on it, because I strongly believe that, you know, what everybody thinks is normal, there isn't any such thing. You know, there's such a spectrum of people in this world across every different aspect of your life, from your skin color to your height, to what we term disabilities that are not really disabilities. Mm-hmm. They are just people with different bodies and different physical attributes, mm-hmm. and even down to different mental attributes such as autism. And we need to be more open to that and to hear these stories. So thank you for inviting me on, and thank you for telling these stories.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. There's also a story in the second season about neurodiversity. So have a listen to it.
Check that out.
and there's another one on disabilities. So that is also out there. Uh-huh. Well, thank you for being part of my project. Thank you again, Louis, for being wonderful. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Mm-hmm.